Out of the Silent Planet, continued. Each minute more handrimmets came into view, long straight lines, some parallel, some intersecting, some building triangles. The landscape became increasingly geometrical. The waste between the purple lines appeared perfectly flat. The rosy color of the petrified forests accounted for its tint immediately below him, but to the north and east the great sand deserts of which the Sorns had told him were now appearing as illimitable stretches of yellow and ochre. To the west a huge discoloration began to show. It was an irregular patch of greenish-blue that looked as if it were sunk below the level of the surrounding Herandra. He concluded it was the forest lowland of the Pififeltrigi, or rather one of their forest lowlands, for now similar patches were appearing in all directions, some of them mere blobs at the intersection of handrimmets, some of vast extent. He became vividly conscious that his knowledge of Malacandra was minute, local, parochial. It was as if a Sorn had journeyed 40 million miles to the earth and spent his stay there between Worthing and Brighton. He reflected that he would have very little to show for his amazing voyage if he survived it. A smattering of the language, a few landscapes, some half-understood physics. But where were the statistics, the history, the broad survey of extraterrestrial conditions which such a traveler ought to bring back? Those handrimmets, for example, seen from the height which the spaceship had now attained in all their unmistakable geometry, they put to shame his original impression that they were natural valleys. They were gigantic feats of engineering about which he had learned nothing, feats accomplished, if all were true, before human history began, before animal history began. Or was that only mythology? He knew it would seem like mythology when he got back to Earth, if he ever got back. But the presence of Oyarsa was still too fresh a memory to allow him any real doubts. It even occurred to him that the distinction between history and mythology might be itself meaningless outside the Earth. The thought baffled him, and he turned again to the landscape below, the landscape which became every moment less of a landscape and more of a diagram. By this time, to the east, a much larger and darker patch of discoloration than he had yet seen was pushing its way into the reddish ochre of the Malacandrian world. A curiously shaped patch, with long arms or horns extended on each side, and a sort of bay between them, like the concave side of a crescent. It grew and grew. The wide dark arms seemed to be spread out to engulf the whole planet. Suddenly he saw a bright point of light in the middle of this dark patch, and realized that it was not a patch on the surface of the planet at all, but the black sky showing behind her. The smooth curve was the edge of her disk. At this, for the first time since their embarkation, fear took hold of him. Slowly, yet not too slowly for him to see, the dark arms spread farther and ever farther around the lighted surface till at last they met. The whole disk, framed in blackness, was before him. The faint percussions of the meteorites had long been audible. The window through which he was gazing was no longer definitely beneath him. His limbs, though already very light, were almost too stiff to move, and he was very hungry. He looked at his watch. He had been at his post, spellbound, for nearly 8 hours. He made his way with difficulty to the sunward side of the ship and reeled back, almost blinded with the glory of the light. Groping, he found his darkened glasses in his old cabin and got himself food and water. Weston had rationed them strictly in both. He opened the door of the control room and looked in. Both the partners, their faces drawn with anxiety, were seated before a kind of metal table. It was covered with delicate, gently vibrating instruments in which crystal and fine wire were the predominant materials. Both ignored his presence. For the rest of the silent journey, he was free of the whole ship. When he returned to the dark side, the world they were leaving hung in the star-strewn sky not much bigger than our earthly moon. Its colors were still visible, a reddish-yellow disk blotched with greenish-blue and capped with white at the poles. He saw the two tiny Malacandrian moons, their movement quite perceptible, and reflected that they were among the thousand things he had not noticed during his sojourn there. He slept and woke and saw the disk still hanging in the sky. It was smaller than the moon now. Its colors were gone except for a faint, uniform tinge of redness in its light. Even the light was not now incomparably stronger than that of the countless stars which surrounded it. It had ceased to be Malacandra. It was only Mars. He soon fell back into his old routine of sleeping and basking, punctuated with the making of some scribbled notes for his Malacandrian dictionary. He knew that there was very little chance of his being able to communicate his new knowledge to man, that unrecorded death in the depth of space would almost certainly be the end of their adventure. But already it had become impossible to think of it as space. Some moments of cold fear he had, but each time they were shorter and more quickly swallowed up in a sense of awe which made his personal fate seem wholly insignificant. He could not feel that they were an island of life journeying through an abyss of death. He felt almost the opposite, that life was waiting outside the little iron eggshell in which they rode, ready at any moment to break in, and that if it killed them, it would kill them by excess of its vitality. He hoped passionately that if they were to perish, they would perish by the unbodying of the spaceship, and not by suffocation within it. To be let out, to be set free, to dissolve into the ocean of eternal noon, seemed to him at certain moments a consummation even more desirable than their return to Earth. And if he had felt some such lift of the heart when he first passed through heaven on their outward journey, he felt it now tenfold, for now he was convinced that the abyss was full of life in the most literal sense, full of living creatures. His confidence in Oyarsa's words about the Eldala increased rather than diminished as they went on. He saw none of them. The intensity of light in which the ship swam allowed none of the fugitive variations which would have betrayed their presence. But he heard, or thought he heard, all kinds of delicate sound, or vibrations akin to sound, mixed with the tinkling rain of meteorites. And often the sense of unseen presences, even within the spaceship, became irresistible. It was this, more than anything else, that made his own chances of life seem so unimportant. He and all his race showed small and ephemeral against a background of such immeasurable fullness. His brain reeled at the thought of the true population of the universe, the three-dimensional infinitude of their territory, and the unchronicled eons of their past. But his heart became steadier than it had ever been. It was well for him that he had reached this frame of mind before the real hardships of their journey began. Ever since their departure from Malacandra, the thermometer had steadily risen. Now it was higher than it had stood at any time on their outward journey. And still it rose. The light also increased. Under his glasses he kept his eyes habitually tight shut, opening them only for the shortest time for necessary movements. He knew that if he reached Earth it would be with permanently damaged sight. But all this was nothing to the torment of heat. All three of them were awake for 24 hours out of the 24, enduring with dilated eyeballs, blackened lips, and froth-flecked cheeks the agony of thirst. It would be madness to increase their scanty rations of water, madness even to consume air in discussing the question. He saw well enough what was happening. In his last bid for life, Weston was venturing inside the Earth's orbit, leading them nearer the sun than man, perhaps than life, had ever been. Presumably this was unavoidable. One could not follow a retreating Earth round the rim of its own wheeling course. They must be trying to meet it, to cut across. It was madness. But the question did not much occupy his mind. It was not possible for long to think of anything but thirst. One thought of water, then one thought of thirst, then one thought of thinking of thirst, then of water again. And still the thermometer rose. The walls of the ship were too hot to touch. It was obvious that a crisis was approaching. In the next few hours it must kill them or get less. It got less. There came a time when they lay exhausted and shivering in what seemed the cold, though it was still hotter than any terrestrial climate. Weston had so far succeeded. He had risked the highest temperature at which human life could theoretically survive, and they had lived through it. But they were not the same men. Hitherto, Weston had slept very little, even in his watches off. Always after an hour or so of uneasy rest, he'd return to his charts and to his endless, almost despairing calculations. You could see him fighting the despair, pinning his terrified brain down and again down to the figures. Now he never looked at them. He even seemed careless in the control room. Divine moved and looked like a somnambulist. Ransom lived increasingly on the dark side, and for long hours he thought of nothing. Although the first great danger was past, none of them at this time had any serious hope of a successful issue to their journey. They had now been 50 days without speech in their steel shell, and the air was already very bad. Weston was so unlike his old self that he even allowed Ransom to take his share in the navigation. Mainly by signs, but with the help of a few whispered words, he taught him all that was necessary at this stage of the journey. Apparently they were racing home, but with little chance of reaching it in time, before some sort of cosmic trade wind. A few rules of thumb enabled Ransom to keep the star which Weston pointed out to him in its position at the center of the skylight, but always with his left hand on the bell to Weston's cabin. This star was not the Earth. The days, the purely theoretical days which bore such a desperately practical meaning for the travelers, mounted to 58 before Weston changed course, and a different luminary was in the center. 60 days, and it was visible a planet. 66, and it was like a planet seen through field glasses. 70, and it was like nothing that Ransom had ever seen. A little dazzling disk too large for a planet and far too small for the moon. Now that he was navigating, his celestial mood was shattered. Wild animal thirst for life, mixed with homesick longing for the free airs and the sights and smells of Earth, for grass and meat and beer and tea and the human voice, awoke in him. At first, his chief difficulty on watch had been to resist drowsiness. Now, though the air was worse, feverish excitement kept him vigilant. Often when he came off duty, he found his right arm stiff and sore. For hours he had been pressing it unconsciously against the control board, as if his puny thrust could spur the spaceship to yet greater speed. Now they had 20 days to go. 19, 18, and on the white terrestrial disk, now a little larger than a sixpence, he thought he could make out Australia and the southeast corner of Asia. Hour after hour, though the markings moved slowly across the disk with the Earth's diurnal revolution, the disk itself refused to grow larger. "Get on, get on," Ransom muttered to the ship. Now 10 days were left, and it was like the moon, and so bright that they could not look steadily at it. The air in their little sphere was ominously bad, but Ransom and Devine risked a whisper as they changed watches. "We'll do it," they said. "We'll do it yet." On the 87th day, when Ransom relieved Devine, he thought there was something wrong with the Earth. Before his watch was done, he was sure. It was no longer a true circle, but bulging a little on one side. It was almost pear-shaped. When Weston came on duty, he gave one glance at the skylight, rang furiously on the bell for Devine, thrust Ransom aside, and took the navigating seat. His face was the color of putty. He seemed to be about to do something to the controls, but as Devine entered the room, he looked up and shrugged his shoulders with a gesture of despair. Then he buried his face in his hands and laid his head down on the control board. Ransom and Devine exchanged glances. They bundled Weston out of the seat. He was crying like a child, and Devine took his place. And now at last Ransom understood the mystery of the bulging Earth. What had appeared as a bulge on one side of her disk was becoming increasingly distinct as a second disk, a disk almost as large in appearance as her own. It was covering more than half of the Earth. It was the moon, between them and the Earth, and 240,000 miles nearer. Ransom did not know what fate this might mean for the spaceship. Devine obviously did, and never had he appeared so admirable. His face was as pale as Weston's, but his eyes were clear and preternaturally bright. He sat crouched over the controls like an animal about to spring, and he was whistling very softly between his teeth. Hours later, Ransom understood what was happening. The moon's disk was now larger than the Earth's, and very gradually it became apparent to him that both disks were diminishing in size. The spaceship was no longer approaching either the Earth or the moon. It was farther away from them than it had been half an hour ago, and that was the meaning of Devine's feverish activity with the controls. It was not merely that the moon was crossing their path and cutting them off from the Earth. Apparently, for some reason, probably gravitational, it was dangerous to get too close to the moon, and Devine was standing off into space. Inside of harbor, they were being forced to turn back to the open sea. He glanced up at the chronometer. It was the morning of the 88th day, 2 days to make the Earth, and they were moving away from her. "I suppose this finishes us," he whispered. "Expect so," whispered Devine, without looking round. Weston presently recovered sufficiently to come back and stand beside Devine. There was nothing for Ransom to do. He was sure now that they were soon to die. With this realization, the agony of his suspense suddenly disappeared. Death, whether it came now or some 30 years later on Earth, rose up and claimed his attention. There are preparations a man likes to make. He left the control room and returned into one of the sunward chambers, into the indifference of the moveless light, the warmth, the silence, and the sharp-cut shadows. Nothing was farther from his mind than sleep. It must have been the exhausted atmosphere which made him drowsy. He slept. He awoke in almost complete darkness in the midst of a loud, continuous noise, which he could not at first identify. It reminded him of something he seemed to have heard in a previous existence. It was a prolonged drumming noise close above his head. Suddenly his heart gave a great leap. "Oh, God," he sobbed. "Oh, God, it's rain." He was on Earth. The air was heavy and stale about him, but the choking sensations he had been suffering were gone. He realized that he was still in the spaceship. The others, in fear of its threatened unbodying, had characteristically abandoned it the moment it touched Earth and left him to his fate. It was difficult in the dark and under the crushing weight of terrestrial gravity to find his way out, but he managed it. He found the manhole and slithered, drinking great draughts of air, down the outside of the sphere. Slipped in mud, blessed the smell of it, and at last raised the unaccustomed weight of his body to its feet. He stood in pitch-black night under torrential rain. With every pore of his body he drank it in. With every desire of his heart he embraced the smell of the field about him, a patch of his native planet where grass grew, where cows moved, where presently he would come to hedges and a gate. He had walked about half an hour when a vivid light behind him and a strong momentary wind informed him that the spaceship was no more. He felt very little interest. He had seen dim lights, the lights of men, ahead. He contrived to get into a lane, then into a road, then into a village street. A lighted door was open. There were voices from within, and they were speaking English. There was a familiar smell. He pushed his way in, regardless of the surprise he was creating, and walked to the bar. "A pint of bitter, please," said Ransom. Chapter 22, The Last Chapter. At this point, if I were guided by purely literary considerations, my story would end. But it is time to remove the mask and to acquaint the reader with the real and practical purpose for which this book has been written. At the same time, he will learn how the writing of it became possible at all. Dr. Ransom, and at this stage it will become obvious that that is not his real name, soon abandoned the idea of his Malachandrian dictionary, and indeed all idea of communicating his story to the world. He was ill for several months, and when he recovered he found himself in considerable doubt as to whether what he remembered had really occurred. It looked very like a delusion produced by his illness, and most of his apparent adventures could, he saw, be explained psychoanalytically. He did not lean very heavily on this fact himself, for he had long since observed that a good many real things in the fauna and flora of our own world could be accounted for in the same way, if you started with the assumption that they were illusions. But he felt that if he himself half doubted his own story, the rest of the world would disbelieve it completely. He decided to hold his tongue, and there the matter would have rested, but for a very curious coincidence. This is where I come into the story. I had known Dr. Ransom slightly for several years, and corresponded with him on literary and philological subjects, though we very seldom met. It was therefore quite in the usual order of things that I should write him a letter some months ago, of which I will quote the relevant paragraphs. It ran like this. "I am now working at the Platonists of the 12th century, and incidentally discovering that they wrote damnably difficult Latin. In one of them, Bernardus Silvestris, there is a word I should particularly like your views on, the word Oiarses. It occurs in the description of a voyage through the heavens, and an Oiarses seems to be the intelligence or tutelary spirit of a heavenly sphere, i.e. in our language of a planet. I asked C.J. about it, and he says it ought to be Ausiarches. That, of course, would make sense, but I do not feel quite satisfied. Have you by any chance ever come across a word like Oyarses? Or can you hazard any guess as to what language it may be? The immediate result of this letter was an invitation to spend a weekend with Dr. Ransom. He told me his whole story, and since then he and I have been almost continuously at work on the mystery. A good many facts, which I have no intention of publishing at present, have fallen into our hands. Facts about planets in general, and about Mars in particular. Facts about medieval Platonists, and, not least in importance, facts about the professor to whom I am giving the fictitious name of Weston. A systematic report of these facts might, of course, be given to the civilized world, but that would almost certainly result in universal incredulity and in a libel action from Weston. At the same time, we both feel that we cannot be silent. We are being daily confirmed in our belief that the Oyarses of Mars was right when it said that the present celestial year was to be a revolutionary one, that the long isolation of our own planet is nearing its end, and that great doings are on foot. We have found reason to believe that the medieval Platonists were living in the same celestial year as ourselves, in fact, that it began in the 12th century of our era, and that the occurrence of the name Oyarsa, Latinized as Oyarses, in Bernardus Silvestris, is not an accident. And we have also evidence, increasing almost daily, that Weston, or the force or forces behind Weston, will play a very important part in the events of the next few centuries, and, unless we prevent them, a very disastrous one. We do not mean that they are likely to invade Mars. Our cry is not merely, "Hands off Malacandra." The dangers to be feared are not planetary, but cosmic, or at least solar, and they are not temporal, but eternal. More than this it would be unwise to say. It was Dr. Ransom who first saw that our only chance was to publish in the form of fiction what would certainly not be listened to as fact. He even thought, greatly overrating my literary powers, that this might have the incidental advantage of reaching a wider public, and that certainly it would reach a great many people sooner than Weston. To my objection that if accepted as fiction, it would be for that very reason regarded as false, he replied that there would be indications enough in the narrative for the few readers, the very few, who at present were prepared to go further into the matter. "And they," he said, "will easily find out you or me, and will easily identify Weston. Anyway," he continued, "what we need for the moment is not so much a body of belief as a body of people familiarized with certain ideas. And if we could even effect in 1% of our readers a changeover from the conception of space to the conception of heaven, we should have made a beginning." What neither of us foresaw was the rapid march of events which was to render the book out of date before it was published. These events have already made it rather a prologue to our story than the story itself. But we must let it go as it stands. For the later stages of the adventure, well, it was Aristotle, long before Kipling, who taught us the formula, "That is another story." Postscript. Being extracts from a letter written by the original of Dr. Ransom to the author. "I think you are right, and after the two or three corrections marked in red, the MS will have to stand. I don't deny that I'm disappointed, but then any attempt to tell such a story is bound to disappoint the man who has really been there. I am not now referring to the ruthless way in which you have cut down all the philological part, though, as it now stands, we are giving our readers a mere caricature of the Malacandrian language. I mean something more difficult, something which I couldn't possibly express. How can one get across the Malacandrian smells? Nothing comes back to me more vividly in my dreams, especially the early morning smell in those purple woods, where the very mention of early morning and woods is misleading because it must set you thinking of earth and moss and cobwebs and the smell of our own planet. But I'm thinking of something totally different, more aromatic. Yes, but then it is not hot or luxurious or exotic, as that word suggests. Something aromatic, spicy, yet very cold, very thin, tingling at the back of the nose. Something that did to the sense of smell what high, sharp violin notes do to the ear. And mixed with that, I always hear the sound of the singing, great hollow hound-like music from enormous throats, deeper than Shalyapian, a warm, dark noise. I am homesick for my old Malacandrian valley when I think of it. Yet God knows when I heard it there I was homesick enough for the earth. Of course, you are right. If we are to treat it as a story, you must telescope the time I spent in the village during which nothing happened. But I grudge it. Those quiet weeks, the mere living among the Hrossa, are to me the main thing that happened. I know them, Lewis. That's what you can't get into a mere story. For instance, because I always take a thermometer with me on a holiday, it has saved many a one from being spoiled, I know that the normal temperature of a Hross is 103 degrees. I know, though I can't remember learning it, that they live about 80 Martian years, or 160 Earth years, that they marry at about 20, or 40, in our years, that their droppings, like those of the horse, are not offensive to themselves, or to me, and are used for agriculture, that they don't shed tears or blink, that they do get, as you would say, elevated, but not drunk, on a gaudy night, of which they have many. But what can one do with these scraps of information? I merely analyze them out of a whole living memory that can never be put into words, and no one in this world will be able to build up from such scraps quite the right picture. For example, can I make even you understand how I know, beyond all question, why it is that the Malacandrians don't keep pets and, in general, don't feel about their lower animals as we do about ours? Naturally, it is the sort of thing they themselves could never have told me. One just sees why when one sees the three species together. Each of them is to the others both what a man is to us and what an animal is to us. They can talk to each other, they can cooperate, they have the same ethics. To that extent, a Sorn and a Hross meet like two men. But then each finds the other different, funny, attractive as an animal is attractive. Some instinct starved in us, which we try to soothe by treating irrational creatures almost as if they were rational, is really satisfied in Malacandra. They don't need pets. By the way, while we are on the subject of species, I am rather sorry that the exigencies of the story have been allowed to simplify the biology so much. Did I give you the impression that each of the three species was perfectly homogeneous? If so, I misled you. Take the Hrossa. My friends were black Hrossa, but there are also silver Hrossa, and in some of the western Handramits one finds the great crested Hross, 10 feet high, a dancer rather than a singer, and the noblest animal after man that I have ever seen. Only the males have the crest. I also saw a pure white Hross at Meldalorn, but like a fool I never found out whether he represented a subspecies or was a mere freak like our terrestrial albino. There is also at least one other kind of Sorn besides the kind I saw, the Soraborn, or Red Sorn of the desert, who lives in the sandy north. He's a corker by all accounts. I agree it is a pity I never saw the Pfiffeltrigi at home. I know nearly enough about them to fake a visit to them as an episode in the story, but I don't think we ought to introduce any mere fiction. True in substance sounds all very well on Earth, but I can't imagine myself explaining it to Oyarsa, and I have a shrewd suspicion, see my last letter, that I have not heard the end of him. Anyway, why should our readers, you seem to know the devil of a lot about them, who are so determined to hear nothing about the language, be so anxious to know more of the Pfiffeltrigi? But if you can work it in, there is, of course, no harm in explaining that they are oviparous and matriarchal, and short-lived compared with the other species. It is pretty plain that the great depressions which they inhabit are the old ocean beds of Malacandra. Hrossa, who have visited them, describe themselves as going down into deep forests over sand, the bone stones, fossils, of ancient wave-borers about them. No doubt these are the dark patches seen on the Martian disk from Earth. And that reminds me, the maps of Mars which I have consulted since I got back are so inconsistent with one another that I have given up the attempt to identify my own Handramit. If you want to try your hand, the Desideratum is a roughly northeast and southwest canal cutting a north and south canal not more than 20 miles from the equator. But astronomers differ very much as to what they can see. Now, as to your most annoying question, did Augrey, in describing the Eldala, confuse the ideas of a subtler body and a superior being? This book is continued on cassette number 7, side 1.